You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of GNAT TV's In-Depth Series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Thursday, June 16th. It's also a great pleasure to be joined in our virtual studio by Chris Winters, who is currently the Deputy Secretary of State here in Vermont. As many of you know, he is a candidate for the Secretary of State position, which became open earlier this year when incumbent officeholder James Condos announced he was going to be stepping down after the conclusion of his current term later this year. So Mr. Winters is one of three candidates who are running in the Democrat primary, which will be held on August 9th, and we will be talking to all three by the time we get to that point, or well before it, I hope. And today, it's our opportunity to hear from Mr. Winters about what are some of his priorities of the job if he's elected. And Chris, great to have you back with us here on the News Project. I recall it was about 2 or 3 months ago, I think it was, so we had you and Mr. Condos on for a discussion about Sunshine Week.
That's right. Yeah, thank you, Andrew. Thanks for having me on, and I really enjoyed our discussion last time when we were talking about open and transparent government.
Well, great to have you back again, and thank you for making the time for our conversation today. So let's get started then, and I suppose we'll just begin with the obvious question. Why are you running?
Sure. Thanks for the question. And as you stated in the opening and the introduction, thank you for that introduction. When Jim Condos announced that he was retiring, I knew that I had to step up. As Deputy Secretary of State, I understand what's at stake with the Secretary of State's office. The challenges that we're facing today are really unlike anything we've ever seen before. Election integrity is constantly under attack. Access to voting is being restricted in ways we couldn't have imagined just a few years ago. Yet in Vermont, we've taken a much different approach. We've led the nation in voting access. We've led the nation in things like professional regulation, something else the office does, and in all of the services that Vermonters and Vermont businesses rely on. So I want to take my 25 years of experience, the last seven as Deputy Secretary of State, and ensure that we have a leader in that office who has a track record, a record of results. And as I like to say, I am the only candidate in this race who could hit the ground running and be ready to lead on day one.
Well, I'm sure that until very recently, a lot of people had a kind of a fuzzy notion about what the Secretary of State did. And of course, that position has been a lot in the news lately. Since the 2020 presidential election, and all of a sudden everyone realizing that the Secretary of State of each state, each one of the 50 states, plays an extremely important role in overseeing state elections and federal elections within the state. But I want to drill down and talk a little bit more about that, but first, I thought I'd like to have you hear from you and tell us a little bit about what are some of the other jobs that the Secretary of State does in addition to overseeing elections.
Well, thank you for asking that. Of course, everyone is really focused on elections, as they should be. It's probably the most important thing that we can do is protecting the right to vote. But there are many other things that the Secretary of State's office does that affect Vermonters' lives every single day. Over the years, the Secretary of State kind of evolved into that place where when you don't know where else to put it, let's put it with the Secretary of State's office. So for such a small agency, we have a broad range of responsibilities. Some of the major divisions that I now oversee, there are four major divisions. There's elections, and then there's professional regulation. That's actually the largest division of the Secretary of State's office that licenses and oversees 50 professions and 80,000 licensees. So that's everything from accountants to tattooists, pharmacists and nurses. Most Vermonters see one of our licensed professionals just about every single day, at least once a week. So there's a real public protection aspect to the Secretary of State's office that's complicated and something that I oversaw for several years. The third division, besides elections and professional regulation, is corporations or business registration. So we're the first stop for any registered business in the state of Vermont. Anyone doing business has to come through our virtual doors and register their business, and we've worked really hard to make that process easy so that we don't get in the way of businesses and startups and entrepreneurs. And the fourth division, another very important division, is the Vermont State Archives and Records Administration, also known as VASARA, is our short for it, our name for it. It's a warehouse. Most people don't realize we have a giant warehouse in Middlesex that has millions of cubic feet of paper records, terabytes and terabytes of digital records, and a climate-controlled archive vault itself where we keep our most precious documents. So we keep track of the state records and the state's history, which is another really important service. And then beyond those four divisions, we have other services like municipal services where we provide advice. It's what we were on the show talking to you about a few weeks ago, about the open meeting law and the Public Records Act and the public's right to know, another very important way to keep your government accountable. And then other things like temporary officiants, where you can become a wedding officiant for a day, and the Safe at Home program, which is an address confidentiality program to protect those who are victims of violence, stalking, and abuse from their abusers. So that's just a few of the things. There's a whole lot more. It's a big job, and it's a lot to manage.
You're right. The state archives in Middlesex are fascinating. I had the pleasure of going there once myself, must be about 10 or so years ago now. And there really are some amazing documents that are being held there. It's a place everybody ought to go to at least once.
Definitely.
But anyway, well, let's turn to the election issue, because I know that's probably on the minds of a lot of folks, and it probably is one of the most important things the office handles. I guess, we've been hearing a lot, and pretty recently with the congressional hearings on the January 6th event now underway, about election results not being tabulated correctly or fraudulent returns thrown in. I guess I'm just wondering, in your opinion, here in Vermont, is that a problem, or is that just sort of an overinflated concern?
Yeah, watching the January 6th hearings really brings back that sick feeling that I had in my stomach when I saw it happening live some 18 months ago. We had just come through the 2020 election. We had a really successful election in the middle of a pandemic. We worked so hard to make sure that every Vermonter could vote in the middle of COVID in a high turnout presidential election. We wanted to make sure that no Vermonter had to choose between their health and their right to vote. We were able to put in place procedures to allow that to happen by mailing out a ballot to every voter and allowing them to choose, am I going to do it by mail? Will I drop it in a drop box, or will I show up in person? So after all that hard work, we were then hearing what we now refer to as the big lie. And I think it's being exposed in these January 6th hearings again, yet again, that there were no problems with the election. There was no rigged vote. There was no widespread voter fraud. And folks at the top actually know that, but continue to spread misinformation. And it's really done damage to people's faith and trust in elections. And the next Secretary of State needs to be on guard for that information, to push back against it as Vermont has, and to try to rebuild that faith and trust by being very transparent about how elections work. And when I talk to people, when I talk to voters who have some questions, they may believe some of the things that they're hearing, or just have questions because they're hearing so much information about elections. When I talk to them, I ask them to talk to their town clerks. I explain how elections are set up. I'm very transparent about how elections really work. And once people understand how many people are involved, what kinds of checks and balances, what kind of oversight, how decentralized it is, how it's done at the local level, they start to understand that these conspiracies that they're hearing about are just not possible.
Now, will there be any differences this year in voting, on both in the primary election and the general election, compared to 2020? I know 2 years ago your office implemented a lot of changes, made mail-in voting a lot easier. Are we going to be seeing the same things this year, or are we going back to an earlier way of doing business?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. It's the same as it was in 2020, but just to remind folks, For the primary, you will not automatically receive a ballot. You have to request one if you'd like to vote by mail or vote early. So request your ballot either from your town clerk or online through our My Voter page. All voters will get a reminder postcard in the mail actually going out this week to let you know that if you want to vote on the vote by mail for the primary on August 9th, you need to request your ballot. For the general election, we now have permanent mailed out ballots. So you will receive a ballot in the general election for November 8th. It comes out about 45 days ahead of time. So if you've requested a ballot for the August primary already, you'll be seeing that right around June 25th, maybe even a little bit before that. But for the general election, you'll be automatically mailed a ballot if you're an active registered voter.
One of the other wrinkles in voting I've been hearing a lot about lately is ranked choice voting. And I know that's not a familiar concept to a lot of folks, but basically, as I understand it, you can correct me since I'm sure you studied this issue a lot more closely than I have. You vote for your favorite candidate, but you also have the opportunity to vote for a second choice or a third choice. And then if no one gets 50% of the vote plus one, those second choice selections kick in and help determine a winner. I know there are a couple of towns in Vermont. I think Burlington is one that is at least did adopt it for a while. I don't recall off the top of my head if they still use that or not. But I guess I just thought, what do you think about that? Do you think that's a method that would be wise to have on a statewide basis, or is it just too problematic?
I like ranked choice voting. I'm in favor of ranked choice voting, and I think we ought to try it in Vermont, but that we need to do it carefully and thoughtfully in order for it to really succeed and be embraced. And I think Vermonters would embrace it once they understood it, but we have to be careful and educate first. It was used in Burlington, and there was a bad experience with it in Burlington, I think, that made it go away and not come back for a number of years, but they've just brought it back. It just passed the legislature this year, a Burlington City Charter, to bring back ranked choice voting. So we can watch and see how that works for the Burlington City Council races in the coming years. But I want to start a conversation about ranked choice voting in January. The timing is right in between election cycles to talk about it again. But Vermont's been a leader nationally when it comes to election reforms. The fact that we have same-day registration, automatic voter registration, that we now have vote by mail, things like ballot curing and lots of opportunity for early no-excuse absentee voting, we're looked at as the gold standard for ballot box access, and it leads to great turnout and participation in Vermont. Ranked choice voting is another thing that I think will make Vermonters feel like their vote really counts. And you explained some of the reasons why it's important. Ranked choice voting can make sure that candidates who win have a majority of votes, so at least 50%. It leads to less negative campaigning because the candidates are also campaigning for those second place votes. And it allows you to vote your conscience instead of voting strategically. You know, personally, I'm tired of voting against certain candidates, especially in things like a presidential primary, voting strategically, trying to make sure that my vote doesn't help the candidate that I don't want to win. And you can do that with ranked choice voting, but we have to do it carefully and we have to make sure the public is fully educated and on board about how it works. Otherwise, again, we don't want to shake confidence in elections any further than it already has been shaken recently. There've been a lot of changes.
And there's also been a conversation underway in certain parts of the state about allowing folks who are under 18 to vote or are not yet citizens of the U.S. to vote in local elections. What do you think about that? Is that starting to get too far afield from kind of a comfortable standard, or should we start to think about allowing, you know, under 18s and non-citizens to vote in certain elections?
Yeah, I think that's a local decision, and we should support that local decision on local initiatives. Some of the best conversations I've had about politics have been with my kids. You know, my daughter, just before she turned 18, was really politically interested and active. And I think it's great to get young people especially involved and engaged in their community and have a stake in things at a young age, because it leads to further involvement as they get older and, you know, filling some of those positions that we desperately need people for in local government. And with respect to non-citizen voting, you know, that's it's voting on local issues. It's folks who are, you know, really solid members of their community. They live here, they pay taxes, they want to have a say in local issues. And if their town or city wants that, we should support that. And we do with things like non-citizen voting for Winooski and for Montpelier. Brattleboro tried to pass the 16 or 17-year-old voting, but it was vetoed by the governor. But I think we ought to support it if that's the what the local municipality wants.
And one last question on voting before we move on to the other aspects of the job. I was just wondering, you know, we tend to celebrate, when, it seems like, whenever we get like a 50 or 60% turnout of voters in an election, which, you know, I guess relatively speaking is okay. But I've often thought, gee, well, that's not really that good. I mean, why aren't we talking 80 or 90% turnout, whether it's voting by mail or in person? And I guess I just wondered, is there some way beyond perhaps making it easier for people to vote absentee or vote by mail that we can make it easier for people to vote so that we do get something closer to, like, say, an 80 or 90% turnout, at least in federal elections?
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, we had, I think it was 74% turnout in the 2020 presidential election, and that was the record. We can do better. We need to do better. And we've done so much to make voting accessible and easy. How do we get people engaged? And, you know, for one, it's them having something worth voting for on the ballot. So I think it means getting good candidates on the ballot. But beyond that, I think civic engagement and civics education could really go a long ways to getting, like I said, getting young people engaged and voting at an earlier age. If I'm elected Secretary of State, I want to bring back some of the civics education that we had under Secretary Markowitz before Secretary Kondos. She was really big on that. And, you know, I was in the office then. She did a lot of work going into schools, doing mock elections, providing civics resources. It's time for us to refresh those materials and make those resources available to parents, to educators, and to get kids more involved in being active citizens. And a big part of that is voting. So I'd love to bring some initiatives forward that help engage young people and hopefully make them active participants in their communities and voters as they get older.
So moving on then, you know, maintaining public records is, or overseeing public records is another part of what would be your job if you're elected in November. And I guess I found out there are about 260 exemptions to Vermont's Public Records Act.
That's right.
That I guess government agencies can use to keep records out of public view. That sounds like an awful lot, but maybe they're all there for a reason, I'm sure. But I guess I just wonder, should there be more of them or fewer, or are there? Could that list be pared down? I guess is where.
Yeah. So I was the person who everybody called not too long ago to ask questions about open meetings and public records, and we'd often talk about exemptions and that balance between the public's right to know, which is in the Constitution, is based in the Constitution, and is really important to government accountability, and the balance with privacy. So there are some things that should be exempt. And shouldn't be subject to public disclosure, but we need to think very carefully about those, and they grow every single year, you know, from in the low 200s now to over 260. We really need to do a review of all those exemptions, see if we can pare them down, see what's really necessary and really working, what could be consolidated. It's not an easy discussion. It's always a really difficult discussion, but, you know, I totally agree with Secretary Kondos, who's, as soon as he came in as Secretary of State, was talking about transparency and running on that platform. I've lived that my last 25 years in state government, trying to make my small corner of government as transparent as possible. And I think that means really taking a hard look at these exemptions and whether they're really needed. I think we could cut them down significantly.
And I also wanted to ask about the open meeting law. Is that, in your opinion, working well enough, or again, is there some room to do some tweaking here For instance, I remember running across a situation, I think it was a couple of years ago, where there was a controversy about whether or not select board members, it was a good idea for them to text each other during a meeting.
Right.
Is that a violation in some sort of an open meeting because this was a conversation of sorts that, maybe should be public? But I guess I just wondered, that's one small example, but I'd love to hear what your views are on the open meeting law itself in general.
So again, I get all these calls, so I probably have a bit of a skewed view in that I get all the complaints, but I kind of know what's out there and the things that that board members do. Most of them, these are volunteers. They want to do the right thing. They may not necessarily understand the open meeting law, but something like texting during a board meeting, it means you're having a conversation among board members or with someone outside of that open meeting room without the public knowing. And it might be informing your decision. It might be leading you to a certain vote. You might be actually engaging in some bad behavior and trying to have a conversation without the public's knowledge. The point of the open meeting law is that the public has a right to know, the public has a right to attend, and the public has a right to participate. So all of those things need to be done in the open. We provide an open meeting law guide, which is on our website under our municipal section. And we have a dedicated person, our general counsel, who answers these questions all day long. She answers thousands of them every year where citizens interact with their local government, especially, and tries to answer those questions. So the open meeting law is hugely important. It's mostly working well. I think it does work well. There are still going to be examples of bad behavior or unintentional violations of the open meeting law. We have a process for addressing that. One of the things that I would like to discuss going forward is that I think we've learned through COVID and all of these hybrid meetings and remote meetings that public participation goes up when you give folks the remote option. I really think boards and other public bodies ought to consider keeping that remote option, keeping things open and more transparent by allowing for further public participation through remote means. So you can tune in while you're making dinner and then just hop on for the part of the meeting that you want instead of driving down to the local school and sitting through 2 hours of another discussion to get to the piece that you want to listen to or have a comment on. So that's one tweak that I would make. I'd like to discuss requiring remote options for all open meetings going forward. And I know it's tough for some towns that might not have the technology or might not have the setup or might not have the staff, but I think it's worth the discussion to ensure that we have greater public participation in our public meetings.
Well, you anticipated what my next question was going to be, which is about hybrid meetings.
Okay.
And, having sat through several over the past, well, more than several over the past 2 years, is there some boundary line or guideline boundary line to like, how hybrid can we go? Or does it get to a point where, really you need to have at least a couple of people in a room at the town hall or wherever the meeting is, and we just can't, leave everything remote? But I guess, you sort of already answered this before I even asked the question. But I guess, your thoughts are, it sounds like we can expand this a little bit further or push that envelope a little bit farther after our experience in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think especially for the public participation, but for the board members themselves, I do hear the other side of that some members of the public would like to show up and be in person, and you have to have that in-person option as well. They want to speak face to face with the people who represent them. I think that's important too. So when I'm talking about moving fully remote for some things, it's more about public participation than it is for board member participation. But electronic participation has always been allowed, at least for a long time, under the open meeting law. People were, some board members were appearing by phone, but it wasn't generally the standard fare. For the most part, they would be there in person with some options for remote if they were, away on vacation or something like that. So I do think having the in-person aspect is still important, but the increased remote participation by the public, I think, is what I would be looking to change the law for.
And just before we have to run here, I wanted to ask you about the business regulation aspect of this job too. I mean, any changes that you would make there, or is that kind of running as well as we could want it to? And you know, it's fairly seamless for someone who wants to either set up a business or understand what qualifications they might need to get if they want to become, let's say, an accountant or one of the other positions that requires a license in the state. Is there any changes that you would make there if you're elected?
Sure. Well, I think it is running seamlessly. It's really running well. I'm pretty excited that when I go around the state and talk to small businesses, talk to licensees, they're very happy with the service that they get from the Secretary of State's office and how easy it is to register a business or get a license from our Office of Professional Regulation. We've put those services online. We've simplified it just as much as possible. Actually, we could make it even better. I do have some initiatives in mind for what we call our business portal. Right now, someone registers a business, they can also get to the Department of Taxes for their tax ID and the Department of Labor for unemployment insurance. We'd like to expand that so that it's a one-stop shop for small businesses, so they can not only visit those two departments, three departments at once, we'll also connect them to the Agency of Commerce and Community Development for any grants or resources they might be eligible for. And also to, let's say, you know, agriculture license or the Department of Health. Let's put it all under one roof and make it as easy as possible for a small business to get in there, get registered, get the permits they need, not have to worry about pushing paper or cutting red tape or wading through the red tape. They can worry about starting and growing their business instead. So the Vermont Business Portal is something I'm really excited to expand upon over the next few months and years.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there for now, Mr. Winters, but thank you again very much for making the time for our conversation today. Really, I really appreciate that. And well, good luck out there on the campaign trail. And we'll, as I said earlier, we'll be talking to the two opponents you're facing in the Democrat primary, and I hear from them in a couple, the next couple of weeks, I think. And anyway, well, we'll see how it goes, and good luck.
Thank you, Andrew. I really enjoyed the conversation. And just to remind everybody, vote on August 9th for the primary.
And speaking of which, early voting happens later this month, right? People can start voting.
The first vet ballots will be available around June 25th. And if you'd like to vote early or absentee, you need to request your ballot from your town clerk or online at mvp.vermont.gov.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Thanks again.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.